Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Hammond organ. Excellent.
Brooks,
yeah.
Yes.
And Daisy Dunbar, drums. I suppose John Moore's head, O-O-R-S-E-A-D, S-H-E-A-D, was the drone lead guitarist.
Ainsley Dunbar. Wonderful drummer.
Victor Brooks was a doctor of madness for one evening.
Oh, really?
Yes, no.
Look at that perfect segue.
That's a perfect segue. We started recording.
My God.
This is The Word podcast with special guests. Richard Strain.
Hello.
Richard, welcome.
I'm going to
applaud.
It's really lovely to be here.
Excited to see him.
Delightful.
I knew that if all I had to do was stay alive long enough to get the invitation.
Yeah. Yeah.
Last man standing, you know.
You've pretty much succeeded.
Tell us about when Victor Brooks was a member of the Doctors of
Madness. Well, it was the same night that Ray Major of Mott the Hoople was, I think. We were rehearsing guitarists and we gave them both the job the same night and regretted it the next day. So, fortunately, no contracts were signed, but we were looking for a lead guitarist, and then we had a quick sidestep, change of plan, and we thought, no, not guitar, violin, of course, electric violin. We were sort of looking towards John Cale, and so we recruited the young Urban Blitz then instead of Victor Brooks, but the Urban Blitz, yes, he was a violinist and guitarist with us for the golden years of the Doctor's
Madness. But the brilliant thing about Doctor's Madness is you think, because you were so early, I don't think I ever saw you or whatever until about 1977, but of course you started in 1975, so you were actually at that tremendous bridge, as were the Sex Pistols, between the old world of rock and roll and the new world. Because you kind of think punk bands always had, you know...
Of which more, actually, in a moment. Let's do the traditional thing, just to put Richard in context. The question we always ask people when they come on the podcast is what music was in your house when you were growing up as a child? Did your parents have records? And what were they?
They had the old radiogram, you know, with the 78s. And we did have music in the family, but it's slightly tangential, but it's worth telling nonetheless. My mother's two brothers, or two of my mother's brothers, should I say. She did have three, one died. We're in a close harmony combo called the Radio Revellers, which some of your older listeners might remember. Now, the Radio Revellers did actually achieve quite a degree of commercial success. They were that sort of generation who were doing very well before the Second War. Then they went into the RAF and met people like Derek Norden and Frank Muir and you know, came out. They were demobbed and went straight back into sort of what was a sort of music hall vaudeville, doing quite well. They played Radio City Music Hall in New York, and Four Men, One Song was their byline. And they could do this amazing close harmony whistling as well, which is very beautiful. Anyway, they took up their career after the war, and they did things like the Crazy Gang show, and you know, and the concert halls, and they opened for, I think, for Sophie Tucker in the Glasgow Empire, you know, and my uncle Stan, who was a very sort of clubbable, lovely, avuncular figure, always used to take great relish in showing me his press cuttings and say, "Look at this one, the Radio Revellers took the stage." But had little to distinguish them but their snappy hand microphones, you know. the sort of reviews that I was getting a mere 20 to 25 years later. But when Uncle Stan died, Auntie Elsa, sometimes known as the She-Wolf of Buchenwald, said, "We found this fantastic tape," and I won't do the accent, in Stanley's loft, and I thought you might like it. And it was a cassette tape. And I put it on, and it was a sort of BBC light programme broadcast from, it must have been 62 or something, saying, "We've been hearing a lot of talk recently about a phenomenon called Beatlemania that's supposed to be sweeping the nation. We sent our man out into the field to see if there's any truth in it."
So someone, a hapless individual, has put on his trilby and his raincoat and gone up to Halifax or something and said, excuse me, sir.
No sign of it here. It's back to the studio.
Your name's John, George, Paul and Ringo mean anything to you? Oh, no, I haven't heard of them. What about you, sir? Ringo, no, I haven't. What about the names Stan, Al, Fred and Arthur? Oh, yes, that's the Radio Rebel.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Probably the last time that happened.
Literally more famous than the Beatles.
More Revelomania.
For a very brief window.
Oh, that's brilliant.
So how did you get into music, though, with the Doctors of Madness?
I was absolutely besotted by the lyric. I still wouldn't profess to any musical talent whatsoever a mere 35 years later.
For sure.
lyrics was always my thing, and this is the other sort of thread that comes through some ancestral chain, as all of you will find out if you buy my very amusing memoir. My great-great-uncle was Sir Arthur Quiller Couch, who was a great poetry anthologist and had, you know, he compiled the great poetry anthology that was used in schools.
It was.
For the length and breadth of the
absolutely
country.
Absolutely, I remember
years.
It well.
So, you know, there's the word gene, and Uncle Stan being the music gene, it was inevitable that at some point they would clash. What got me into music was poetry, really, and a love of poetry at a ludicrously young age. And I wasn't a swot, but I did love poetry, and I was blessed, as a lot of us are at some point in our lives, with a wonderful teacher who identified some interest and wasn't overweening or overbearing, but just said, well, if you like Bob Dylan, try Allen Ginsberg. If you like Allen Ginsberg, try Ezra Pound. If you like Dylan Thomas, try R.S. Thomas, you know, and just gradually introduced me to all this stuff. And I loved all that, and I was just soaking it up like a sponge. And I wanted to be a poet, but, of course, in the 60s and early 70s, that was no career. You know, you wanted to be in a band if you were a poet, and, you know, you could be both. So Bob Dylan and Lou Reed were my big sort of pillars for me. You know, the first Velvet Underground album I did actually queue up to buy in 1966 at, was it called One
did
Stop
you?
Records?
It must have been
South
a very
Moles
short
Street.
One Stop in South Moles
yeah,
Street.
Yeah, and that was the
where
only
Danny Baker subsequently worked.
There.
Talked about on this
you
podcast.
See, because that was the only place you could get imports, as they were called.
It probably
at the
was,
time.
Yes, yeah.
That was very bold of you, because I would have thought it might have been quite a short queue, because actually that
it was a
sold
very
no copies
queue.
At all. Well, it was only about a year later when it started to get discounted
yeah.
that people started to listen to it. And everyone thinks those things come out of the box as an instant hit, don't
no,
they? They didn't at
no,
all.
No, no. You see, as well as being this insufferable poetry bore, I was always a massive fan of contemporary art. And you know, and this is at the age of 14, 15, where other people went to football matches. I went to Robert Fraser's gallery in Duke Street and soaked up the newest Jim Dine show or Kleist Oldenburg or you know, Andy Warhol. And Warhol was huge for me. So I was very aware of Warhol and, by extension, the Velvet Underground, you know, as soon as it came out. And the story is only 1,100 copies of that album sold in the first flush. You know, the first Velvet, you know.
That's right, yeah.
Brian Eno always says everyone who bought that album went on to form a band.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which is probably true. But only 1,100 of us did buy that album when it first came out. And then it was sort of reevaluated and reissued. And obviously now it's one of those albums that everyone feels that they grew up with. And if you believe everyone, that queue down South Moulton Street
would have gone all the way down.
Was going down yeah. as far as Marble Arch. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Queuing up to get it. But,
how did you form the group, the Doctors of Madness?
Well,
they came together.
So I was supposed to go to university, but my father, in those days, you had to do a sort of fill in forms and get means tested and stuff. My father was very reluctant to disclose his income, not because it was substantial, but because I think he just didn't.
Tax reasons?
I think he was a very, very secretive man. Didn't think it was anyone's business. You know, he was middle management. He was a statistician. And no one in our family had ever been to university, so he didn't see why I should be the first. You know, I was getting a bit up myself. And so I did get offered a place at East Anglia to do Scandinavian studies, of all things. I think there was a girl in the picture living in Oslo.
I would imagine
what
time in Korea that yeah. So, was she Scandinavian?
Funny enough, yeah, Mark, so, she yeah, was... Yeah. Yes, she was. But I was offered the place, and I didn't take it, or I wasn't able to take it, because we couldn't get the funding. And so despite my father, I went off to Copenhagen anyway, and there, in a coffee shop in Copenhagen in 1969, I bought a guitar, my first guitar, very late. I was 18. So no chance of me ever becoming a good player, but I was keen, I was enthusiastic, and pity anyone who was on the receiving end of me strumming away these E and A minor, you know, and singing songs that lasted 25 minutes that were very verbose, but only around a two-chord pattern.
When the Doctors of Madness started, it was pretty much the same time as the Sex Pistols.
No, we started 74.
You were before. But so was your musical vision in any way similar? Because you all kind of joined up a bit later on, which we'll come to.
What happened, my musical vision was predicated principally upon Velvet Underground, David Bowie to an extent, and William Burroughs. They were my big three. And William Burroughs was probably the biggest in terms of an inspiration of what I thought our subject matter was, which was about control. It was about propaganda. It was about slightly sci-fi, slightly futuristic. We would be oddly named characters, hence I became Kid Strange, and we had Urban Blitz and Peter Dilemma, you know, and you know, quite Burroughsian, this sort of dystopian world of William Burroughs, and that really appealed to me. So we took that up, and quite a lot of faffing around over two years of trying out different lineups. So the drummer I'd been to school with, so he was always the stalwart, and the bass player we got in, I'd known him for a while, and I'd never thought he was quite right, but he turned out to be very right. And then we were always lacking this sort of four that we tried out synthesized. We tried out Victor Brox, and, you know, and Ray Major, and, you know, lots of different guitarists. But they weren't making the racket that I could hear in my head. I had this idea of a fantastic racket. You know, if you listen to Velvet Underground, Black Angel Death Song or somewhere, that John Cale's viola is just soaring away there and making just a fabulous racket. We found this guy, Urban Blitz, who was a violinist and viola player and could play a bit of guitar. And as soon as we tried him on a couple of songs, then that was like the missing bit of the puzzle. There we had the sound. So this was 1974. So,
but how did you feel when you've got your sound, which is very much based in the Velvet Underground, hence the fiddle player, I understand that now, when you're suddenly supported by, and we want recollections of all three, I think the Jam, Joy Division, and I think the Sex Pistols. So suddenly this is coming up behind you, underneath you.
Well, what happened was, okay, we settle upon our lineup, and we start to get quite good, because we're very committed to this thing. And I started setting up self-promoted gigs in Twickenham, in a pub in Twickenham called the Cabbage Patch. And this is 1975 by now. And so in 1975, I set up something called A Month of Sundays, which was four consecutive Sundays at the Cabbage Patch. And the first one we got 20 people, the next one we got 40 people, the next one we got 80 people, and the fourth one, we tore the place apart with 150 people in, going mad. And by that time, a sort of word, a bit of a buzz had got out. And at the end of the gig, with our equipment still sort of smoking because we were so good that night on stage, and us in a little broom cupboard before we actually had to undertake that rather humiliating ritual of going to clear the stage ourselves, you know, in front of the fans, and we just rocked into a frenzy.
Yeah, thanks.
There were two knocks on the door in short succession by media professionals. The first one was Jonathan King coming and saying he wanted to manage us.
What was your reaction to that?
Well, we didn't like Genesis, so he didn't have a chance. He was managing Genesis at the time, and we would have no truck with him at all. We were desperate, but not that desperate. And we didn't like him at that time anyway. We thought he was prissy and he was slightly creepy, and as history has later shown us.
Who was the second?
The second one was a cigar-chomping Jewish East End wide boy called Brian Morrison. And Brian Morrison had been in the business in the 60s, managing Pink Floyd, managing T-Rex, managing Ainsley Dunbar Retaliation, the Pretty Things, a lot of bands like that, had got into music publishing, made absolute fortunes with everyone from Pink Floyd to some Bee Gees. So Brian had the B-side of Saturday Night Fever
single.
We sold 20 million.
And you get just
you
as
get
much
as just as much for B-side. It's a great, great pleasure telling
Frankie
them.
Goes to Hollywood, and so, Morley will attest.
Yeah, yes. Exactly. And Brian took great joy in telling me that having a B-side to that record was like having 200 consecutive number ones in this country.
How very demoralising.
You know, that's why, like, you only had to sell 100,000 records to get a number one.
Yeah.
So 20 million worldwide with your song on the B-side is like 200 consecutive number one. Right. Anyway, Morrison came in, chomping on a cigar, said, I've been out of the business some time, my son. That's the best thing I've seen. Someone had told him that we were hot and said, come down and see. If you're looking for a band to get back in the business. Yeah. This was, and he was in partnership with another 60s character called Justin de Villeneuve.
Twiggy's
manager.
Yeah, yeah.
And the two of them, Morrison de Villeneuve, were a management company. And it was like a dream come true for us. There we were. We just rocked Twickenham to its knees. The instruments were still smoking. And Morrison said, come in and see me in Mayfair on Monday, boys, and I'll sign you. And it was like, up until that point, we were semi-pro, I suppose you'd call it.
What can go wrong?
What can go wrong? Yeah. So we went in on Monday, signed here, and here. So that would be management, recording, production, publishing.
First of all,
okay.
Yeah. Houses.
Don't worry cars, about all that.
All material.
And then the deal was he was going to put us into a rehearsal studio for 4 weeks so that we would just get hot. We'd be in there every day. Give your jobs up tomorrow. You're professional musicians now. He hired, you know, PA. It was just over the arches in Charing Cross Road. We found a warehouse and set stuff up there. And that's really how the Doctor Madness wrote and recorded and learned their set. And then at the end of that 4 weeks, he got the big moguls in. Because he was so connected, he got Clive Davis to come in to sit in that chair, you know, slightly moth-eaten, slightly
damp. Which are you in your rehearsal studio?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You played your set?
Sit down, yeah.
Clive Davis, was he running Arista at the time? Or
he was still at CBS, I think.
Yeah.
So he's sitting down in this chair, and we were using quite a lot of sort of low-tech, low-budget theatricality at the time, including smoke and strobes and stuff. So we were doing that. There's a nasty smell of burning. Clive Davis's chair burst into flames. A loose wire underneath it had ignited the kapok or the upholstery that was going. You saw him get out, and he fled. We didn't sign to CBS. But
that's
we
how
did.
Hot the Doctors of Madness are. In the furniture starts to combust. Yeah.
You've been listening to the free feed of the Word podcast. The full album-length version is only available to subscribers to the magazine. To sign up and to hear the rest of this podcast, go to www.wordpodcast.co.uk.